You described the emergence of the new, sort of the imperial sovereign as a sort of a new development. But if you look back in history, this sort of technique has always been there. It was used vis-a-vis, like, in the war, vis-a-vis Japan. It was used in the Cold War vis-a-vis Soviet Union. And there is, like, this conclusion is always there that, like, adventurism and militarism abroad sort of dovetails with political repression and distortion of truth at home. What it is that is sort of different about it, like, especially since you were referring to sort of this post 9/11 scenario and sort of distortion of truths in that context, what is it that is different between this and what went on before?
It's a really, really good question. And both your examples are really good because both of those have to do with the generative logic of American empire itself. First, the war against Japan, which ends with Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The United States is a society, you know, this emblematic society of the dialectic of enlightenment, which at the end of the war decides to place its bets on the end of history itself. And the first time with the dropping of nuclear weapons brings to an end an effective concept of history. If history is something that's undetermined, that can't be controlled, be technologically controlled. Or with the United States, with the whole logic of the Cold War, which it presents itself with missionary consciousness as being, you know, like a redemptive moment for freedom and for democracy. You know, really brilliantly expressed in Tony Judd's book on Europe since 19, his text which analyzes the history of Europe since 1945. What's really different about the phase in which we're living today is it's something that it built on that, but it actually does something different. What it does different, it no longer simply projects itself on externally nominated scapegoats or enemies, Japan, the Soviet Union, etc., and the language of, like, normalizing language of containment, which, you know, turns on both empires, in fact, can live with. And in fact, the, let's say, language of redemptive violence and panic fear, which is simultaneously on deeply eschatological religious grounds projected elsewhere in the world, projected outward in the world, but at the same time also returns domestically and internally to capture the subjectivity of its waiting, you know, its harvest, its population, in a kind of harvesting machine. And where everyone doesn't simply, it's not long along the specter of the terrorist without, it's also the imminent threat grows in society that everyone has not just a little fascist within, but a little terrorist within. It sets up a perfectly open-ended logic of infinite forms of coercion and surveillance and repression itself. And it also opens up a really perspectival concept fiction notion of truth itself. It's not that truth disappears, it's that truth literally becomes an image repertoire. They become like contending truths, or depending on what perspective you happen to have in the culture. You can see in the last American election, there's a concept fiction truth for Republican voters, there's a concept fiction truth for John Kerry Democratic voters. So the analysis I would draw from that is that what is still waiting to be announced, what's still trying to find its generative language of expression in the world, is this new historical form of cynical ideology, which is about compulsive lying in the language of truth itself, which is about redemptive violence and panic fear, and which is about, more than anything, as Heidegger would say, which is the creation of a new ethics, an ethics of abuse value. Nietzsche knew this in the genealogy of morals, where Nietzsche says, you know, the lions like little lambs, they like to eat them. There's lots of pleasures to be taken in conquest, and the pleasures of humiliation itself. So at that libidinal level, is that libidinal level is, I think, where cynical ideology really begins.
One of the reasons I think that we shift to this, that we really endorse everything you're talking about, you know, very passively about cynical ideology, is it really going back to 9/11 and the whole shake of our world, the fact that we're in danger at any end. This is something, of course, that's really trying to be emphasized. If you've seen the Power of Nightmares, if you see series, that we're always in danger, that, you know, now our leaders exist to protect us from our fears. And my question is, do you believe that we as a society can get away from this fear and really acknowledge the fact that this horrific act of 9/11 was one isolated incident and doesn't have the kind of repercussions that's been emphasized and enforced? And if we lose that primal fear of death, you know, going back to Hobbes and going back to that as the role of the state is to protect us, that if we sort of realize that, hey, they're not really protecting us, there's no danger, that does that ideology fall apart from that realization?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I should respond optimistically with a rousing statement on behalf of agency or fearless speech and things like this, all of which I would agree with, and I certainly agree, but I can't today give that. I can't side with that, actually, because I would think that, in fact, the language, there's been such a deep evacuation of the language of freedom and domination itself. It's become ambivalent, twisted terrain. And for myself, this just remains entirely problematic itself. I mean, what to do if we're living in an age in which Adorno was correct, where he says, you know, the power of advertisements, for example, which everyone cynically sees right through, and just goes on living nonetheless, you know, and begins to be seduced by the language of cynicism itself. Now, against that, you know, you could argue for, like, recalcitrant singularity of human subjectivity, which is true. It's like the scholars for 9/11, which such a fearless group of American, you know, truth-sayers, you know, who do the impossible in the American, like, contemporary lexicon, which is they've actually, as a group, have got together on the net. They've actually begun to examine what happened on 9/11. You just read their reports, and it's such a different story that leads to unbelievability itself, except the facts seem to be confirmed one fact upon the other itself. So what happens when fearless speech becomes two things, when it becomes an object of uselessness in society? It simply floats away through the image speculum, the image repertoire itself. Or what happens when fearless speech is actually activated by the system as a means of energizing the system? For myself, it's really, those are like the opening notes of doing political analysis today. So, I've always, you know, and Jim would know this, I've always been really suspicious of Foucault's last run. I like Foucault's last runnings and the cure of the self and things, because I think it's just a magnificent wreckage. It's just a brilliant, eloquent, passionate, filled with integrity failure on his part itself. He couldn't solve, he went to his death not being able to solve the problem that he himself correctly prophesied in advance. That is when he said much earlier in his life that, you know, freedom is acceptable today only to the extent that it places a limit on the powers in which we experience itself. That we love the hint of domination, the specter of death which is contained within the language of freedom. So I think that all of Foucault's thought has been haunted by the irreducibility of the language of power itself. It's a hauntology. So that's not too optimistic an answer. I'm trying to do better next time.
I'm singing or trying to keep a better lookout for Facebook.
Now, when I read later Foucault, I see this sort of pleasant shining light which guides me towards warm thoughts about the transformation of myself and the world. And when I hear your talk, and especially your video, I think of Gothic dungeons. Now, what I'm wondering is how much this might simply be attributable to basic intuitions about one's ability to confront and deal with systems of domination. So in Foucault's lexicon, what you've presented is the fact that there's an elaborate web of domination out there. And what he says is, okay, you've got to start marshalling your abilities of reflexivity and integrity and practices of the self to do something about putting yourself in a better position. And what you seem to be saying is, the dark side has too much power. That's my interpretation. So perhaps you could tell me how you're not saying that.
Well, yeah, because I'm not... All my life I've tried to break away from the dialectic of enlightenment, probably absolutely unsuccessfully. Because I'm not trying to, for example, place normativity on the side and insurrected agency of subjugated knowledge on the other hand. I'm saying they're twisted, they're intertwined with one another. Like remix wars, well, on one side that's gone for sure, but on the other side, it's a, in Toulouse-Lautrec's lines of flight, it's an intensity that seeks to use, you know, like in Jackson's wonderful video making techniques and tiny duties and the poetry of Mary Louise, it seeks to find a way of bringing to an intensity the remix wars and the ambivalent languages of dominations and powers and seductions and remix within which we find ourselves. I mean, I don't think we have agency, we have remix agency. Not one person here has agency. Everyone at the minimum in a technological society has been effectively remixed, you know, looped and mutated and processed and sub-processed, moving sometimes with slownesses and sometimes with power. I mean, there are real political effects which come through, which come out of remix agency. It would mean that we would have to begin a study of, well, what's the language of remix? How do we get remixed with a lie to such an extent that the lie is just taken on as a perspective of truth, or it's joked off at night on, you know, one of the nighttime talk shows and things like this? I mean, how do we live? I mean, what are the actual conditions of living in what Heidegger prophesied would be our age, and I think it's true, in a culture of completed nihilism? And in a culture of completed nihilism, can we go back to modernisms of agency and normativity and fearless speech, when maybe what's necessary is, I don't know, fearful speech? You know, like just ways of twisting, making things a bit more ambivalent, but a much truer, actually, to human subjectivity as the experience. We have to find an answer, because Deleuze and Guattari's warning in the Anti-Oedipus about the fascist within is just becoming the explosive norm of contemporary culture. We desperately have to find an answer.
But the whole process of schizoanalysis,
yeah,
is, I had always read, as a redemptive one of transforming oneself through practices to become other than what one is, to become something new in a way which is life-affirmative, I want to say.
Yes. Well, but for Deleuze and Guattari, for example, that's not true. I mean, you can become maggot man, you can become rat face man, you can become your own little fascist, just as much as you can become wolf man, and then, you know, get your whole romantic spin on this. It's twisted. It's ambivalent. It's the actual field of politics has changed, and consciousness, I believe, has not caught up to it. And that's why it's been, you know, tedious at the first day to think of powers, go back through the history of power, powers reification, powers norm, powers simulation, and powers virtuality, meaning Zizek's powers and symptomology, of Lacanian symptomology and psychopathologies on the one hand, or Virilio, if you want a more tech story, go to Virilio, Power Speed. But even then, Virilio's writing is haunted by the language of power as a vampire. It actually hijacks bodies, it takes possessions of bodies. It moves us to spaces we don't want. It's about, I mean, Foucault in that sense is literally true. Power circulates and it networks. And it's twisted in a deeply, just in the same way that the biogeneticists knew about it when they talked about the double helix, which for myself is a basic metaphor for understanding how anything functions today. I mean, opposites stand in ambivalent, twisted relations with one another. And it's not possible to understand one without the other. So why don't we get down to work, understanding how a remix culture works in this really reactionary time in which we live. Now, I just say one other short thing. I mean, it's not just American story, it's Canadian, eh? I mean, by this morning, you have the pictures of Mr. Harper, who's doing a George Bush light. This time he's not landing on an aircraft carrier, but his image came on the net last night. He's at the control of the plane that's taken him into Kandahar. You know, this little dumpy guy going in, and he doesn't say mission accomplished, but he does say Al-Qaeda has targeted Canada. You know, we are now targets. And feel panic fear, you know, to induce panic fear. You look at Newman's article in the Globe and Mail yesterday, in which he says, you know, explosives are coming in through these container ships, could happen imminently. I mean, a culture of fear is being generated within this culture very, very quickly. So I think we need to learn a little, for myself, I'm trying to learn a political diagnostics of analysis. This is, well, how do you deal with twisted fear and panic culture and reductive violence?
That's okay. Really, really beautiful work, Arthur, always inspiring. And always puts me on a wood path when I listen to you speak. But as you know, I work on a research project with Stephen Mann, and you're familiar with his work. And I want, wouldn't you say that his work on what was suvalence and now he's calling equivalence is not the embodiment of fearless speech in the image repertoire that you're talking about, and that he really can be an example of how that can take place and is taking place by certain people today?
Yep. You know Stephen Prince of Oregon song? Stephen. Yeah. That's true. Yes, definitely. Steve Mann is at the University of Toronto, computer engineering, and does these great projects where he's really analyzing surveillance culture. And he doesn't analyze it from the outside. He makes himself an agent of surveillance, counter-surveillance. He makes prosthetics, and all the students wear around prosthetics around the University of Toronto, in which they can, you know, they'll detect. They say, well, why not someone else? That ain't your reality. That ain't your own reality. And so one eye is a prosthetic eye, and basically allows you to edit, re-edit. You edit on advertisements or anything else you don't see in your life itself. And it also allows you to go into rooms and begin to instantly filter where the detection cameras are and things like this. Now Steve Mann's an excellent example of this, of course. Yeah. On the other hand, he's a really proprietary owner of some major software patents. So he's got his ambivalences and stuff. But he's really, really a visionary political theorist. I mean, Steve Mann, 3 years ago, he has a little art gallery across from the AGO, in which he, you know, he's just really reading the nomenclature and the documents on setting up emergency camps in the United States, you know, the potential emergency camps, under the pretext of biological terrorism or pandemics, as little birds are coming our way. And, like, those are, you know, like within politics, within the language of power, play other roles. So Steve, 3 years ago, set up a biologic. He announced, we put out leaflets in Toronto. I helped him, we just put out leaflets announcing we were going to have like a biological activation site. So people came and that if you come to the exhibit, you would be treated as a humiliated subject. You're going to be stripped, you're going to be photographed, you're going to be treated as an intern within an emergency camp. Well, that was all you had to say. You couldn't stop the crowds from coming in through the whole city itself, which convinced me immediately of this notion of the seduction of domination, this kind of twisted logic itself. Mm-hmm. But Steve set the whole thing up, and it was at that very night, one of the other participants of this, of course, was Steve Kurtz, for the critical art song. He's a friend of mine from back in. You know, he gave a talk, we talked about that, neither of us were to know that within a year, he himself was going to wake up, find his wife has died of a heart attack overnight, and in the process, in his apartment, he's doing a thing for the University of Massachusetts, doing a thing on freak genetics, the dangers of recombinant food, and had little burners going and little samples of certain recombinant things, and the cops come in, and immediately see his wife is dead, and then see this biological experiment going on, and immediately call the hazmat people. And that area of Buffalo is shut down for 3 blocks, everyone's corralled away. His computer's taken, Faith's body is taken, the cat's taken, and Steve himself, to this day, is undergoing judicial proceedings on charges of potential terrorism itself. So who's to know? We're just participants in what we thought was an art exhibit. On emergency procedures, you know, apprehended phony emergency procedures, that within a year, the twists of power would be such, the cynicism of power would be such that it would sweep particularly Steve and his wife up within this machine itself, and it twists and turns and mutates. So.
I just have a question related, I suppose, with the kind of sexuality that seems to be behind much of this power that you're speaking of. I was wondering if maybe you could touch on the dichotomous relationship between masochism and sadism in your analysis. It seems like you're talking about a sadistic power that gets pleasure out of abuse value. Seems like that. And then there would be like this masochistic counter argument to that. I'm not sure what that would be. I was wondering maybe if you could say anything about that.
Well, it's both sadistic, because it gets pleasures of the spectacles of cruelty. And its audience, its willing audience, gets immense pleasures out of this as well. That's why is covered by the media so well, but it's also deeply masochistic. It doesn't only want to have a humiliated subject. It knows it wants to have a humiliated subject because, first of all, it's humiliated itself. You get that from George Bush's demeanor, right? He's like the dumpy, humiliated man. I mean, everybody knows he's not president. He goes on, and he's playing a function role. And this, you know, I think for myself always explains this kind of, like, dumb old kind of look. I don't know what kind of look he has, but this kind of look I wish I were elsewhere on a space and things like this. You know, this is just another responsibility to get. He's like the humiliated person. He has a whole official bureaucracy. He has a whole media who know that he effectively is not the agency of power, that Cheney and another national security state, in fact, are the real agencies of power, that he's performing a function role itself. So I think that power itself is sadistic, but it's also masochistic. It is not just a relation of force. It is also really deeply a relation of weakness. It loves to give away its power. It loves to evacuate its own subjectivity itself. It likes to make a joke of itself. Cheney's, you know, a good example of that. Rumsfeld's a good example of this. You know, this is the way in which our politics operates today. So why should power itself be exempt from, like, the normal rules of sexuality, where sadism is not simply the opposite of masochism, but sadomasochism represents a twisted turning of one register of pleasures and one register of pain into the other itself, both like planes of consistency, both planes of subjectivity. Why shouldn't power be experienced like that? I believe that it is. So for myself, I don't view the language of domination or freedom. For myself, I just think it's just been historically bypassed by an actual objective change in the nature of the field of politics itself. And virtuality really means things in terms of the carceral and seduction pleasures of pains that we experience itself. Probably, you know, the best people have analyzed this, for myself and the American nomenclature, are feminist theory. They really have understood, like, you read Catherine Hills and Judith Butler and Wendy Brown, they really understand what it means when power itself becomes about crossing boundaries and demarcating boundaries itself. And the writing is unfinished because it's problematized a new formation of power.
Well, I think we've got time for one last question, if anyone else wanted to jump in on this. If not, I think we can conclude with that. We're already 20 minutes past time we have slot for, so that's not too bad. We've got another session tomorrow. I invite all of you to come back to that again. If you don't have tickets for it, you can catch it on the net at the same address. So with that, I'd like to extend a thank you to Dr.